You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from London and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, the US presence in Afghanistan, the Bahrain uprising 3 years on, and violence in Venezuela. Those are some of the topics we'll be discussing with the journalists Jeffrey Kaufman and Rachel Shabby. In the second half, we'll turn to a few lighter topics, including the most important part of the Winter Olympics, the commentary. No one is ever happy. This is what has been annoying the Finns.
Kanada tulee, Kanada tulee, Kanada tulee, Kanada vetää. Saadaanko kiekko pois? Ei saada! Ei saada! Megan Agosta!
Well, this is what has been getting on the nerves of the Brits.
Both Ed and Amy crying, and now I'm going!
Oh my God!
All professionalism going straight out the window here!
I think we're allowed to cry though.
Tell me about it. We will also get a roundup of the best of the Istanbul Film Festival and find out what three broken lifts say about an ailing French newspaper. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So, as ever, rather a lot to pack into the next 60 minutes. But before we get started, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines from around the world.
The United Nations aid chief Valerie Amos has urged the UN Security Council to act to increase humanitarian access in Syria as the United States, France and Britain try to find common ground with Russia and China on a draft resolution on the situation there. The UN has said that some 9.3 million Syrians, that's nearly half the country's population, need help. Amos has repeatedly expressed frustration that violence and red tape have slowed humanitarian aid deliveries to a trickle.
I've asked the Security Council members to do everything they can to use their influence over the parties to this appalling conflict to ensure that they abide by humanitarian pauses and ceasefires, give humanitarian actors sustained and regular access, commit in writing to upholding international humanitarian law, allow systematic cross-line access, and prevent our teams from being shot at while delivering aid to people in need.
Meanwhile, in neighbouring Jordan, around 1,000 protesters gathered in downtown Amman today to protest against the US Secretary of State John Kerry's Israeli-Palestinian peace plan. The demonstrators, who belong mostly to Jordan's Muslim Brotherhood, carry banners and chanted slogans against John Kerry and what they call the alternative homeland solution. Italy's Prime Minister has tendered his resignation less than a year after taking charge of the country's latest coalition. Enrico Letta announced he'll stand down hours after his biggest rival in the Democratic Party, Matteo Renzi, called for a change at the top. Mr. Renzi, the mayor of Florence, has warned that Italy faced damaging uncertainty, but he's now poised to become its youngest ever Prime Minister. He's only 39. James Walston is Professor of Italian and Comparative Politics at the American University of Rome.
In some ways it means nothing, because the policies which Renzi is going to follow will be very similar to those which Letta was trying to implement. In other ways, it will be a big change in style. The style, we've seen already the difference in style between Letta and Renzi. Renzi is a much closer person in terms of style of leadership to the other two populists who are not in parliament, Berlusconi and Grillo. So we'll have a lot more show, a lot more words, and possibly more substance, but I'm not so sure.
Meanwhile, Germany's agricultural minister has resigned amid accusations he leaked confidential information about a fellow lawmaker suspected of possessing child pornography, dealing a blow to Chancellor Angela Merkel and her two-month-old government. Hans-Peter Friedrich, a Conservative member of the Bavarian Christian Social Union, said the pressure had grown too much for him to stay in office. Seven suspicious packages sent to army recruitment offices in England contained viable devices bearing the hallmarks of Northern Ireland terrorism, a spokeswoman from Prime Minister David Cameron's office said today. The Irish Republican Army abandoned its armed struggle for an end to British control of Northern Ireland and unification with Ireland in 1998, but the government said that terrorists were continuing to plan attacks with lethal intent. The Assistant Chief of Defence Staff is Major General Patrick Sanders.
Be vigilant, be careful with what you open, but I think this is directive for what we see at the moment, at military establishments and not at the general public.
And finally, a 10-year-old Norwegian boy came up with a novel excuse after he drove his parents' car into a snowy ditch. He told police he was a dwarf who had forgotten his driving license. The boy lives near Dokka, a town about 70 miles north of the capital Oslo. And that story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Well, that was an unexpected end. Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It is 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York City. We're going to start, as ever, with a look back at the day's big stories. And joining me now with their take is Jeffrey Kaufman, the London-based correspondent for ABC News, and Rachel Shabby, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands, both Monocle 24 regulars. Welcome, Rachel. Welcome, Jeffrey. We're going to start with the US presence in Afghanistan. NATO combat troops are due to leave by the end of this year, but an agreement to keep US forces in the country beyond then had been due to be signed by the two governments, the US and Afghanistan. Hamid Karzai, it seems, is less keen to sign on the dotted line. US officials are now prepared to wait him out and deal with his successor after elections planned for April. Jeffrey Kaufman, Hamid Karzai is in a slightly awkward position, isn't he? Because he doesn't want to be seen as an American stooge. He wants to be seen as his own man. And yet at the same time, you know, he knows that actually, arguably, it is in his interest that there is some form of a US presence after the end of this year.
I think the word to describe this whole experience from afar is exasperating, and it must be even more exasperating up close. The inability of the Afghan government to deal with this issue, which is ultimately, as you say, in their interest, is exasperating to any outsider. But then when you look at the politics within, it's just so complicated. We have an election with, what, 11 candidates, many of them ex-warlords. It is an incredibly tense time right now. Karzai's own brother, whom he doesn't particularly get along with, is one of the candidates. And he just doesn't know what he can deliver. So he is punting this off. He's pushing this off. The problem is that they've set a deadline, which is now passing, for Americans to either pull out or stay on. And the Americans simply, after more than 2,000 American casualties and 3,500 coalition casualties over the last decade or so, to completely abandon Afghanistan would be to let it slide back into chaos. And no one wants to see that.
And here's the thing, Rachel, is that actually Hamid Karzai can do this all he wants. The Americans aren't going to say, OK, well, fine, we'll just leave.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's really that exasperating or that surprising that he would be making these moves. I mean, Karzai, obviously, he cannot stand for a third term. He's constitutionally prevented from doing so. So the US really only needs to wait until April before they deal with the incoming after the elections. But of course, you know, it's not as though the Afghan people are in the streets begging the US forces to stay. In fact, quite the opposite. All the polls show that they actually want the US troops to leave, that they see them as the primary source of instability.
The primary source of instability,
more so
than the Taliban.
Absolutely. That is what the polls are showing, that that's what the people in Afghanistan believe. Now, of course, the Taliban are a problem unto their own, but what the people are experiencing, as much as anything, is a complete unravelling of their society since the US invasion, coupled with increasingly civilian deaths. There has been 3,000 in 2013. And the impact, of course, of illegal US drone strikes in Afghanistan, which obviously makes Karzai reluctant to be so accommodating of the US now?
Perhaps, but I mean, you say the unravelling of Afghan society since the US invasion in 2001. Let's not forget that the government in Afghanistan up till that point was the Taliban. I think a lot of people would have liked to see the unravelling of the Taliban society.
Yeah, but it's not as though the US invasion succeeded in ousting the Taliban, is it? I mean, they're back and they're back in full force, and behind them are various other warlords that may or may less be or not be palatable. According to the Afghan people, they're just as scared of what lies beyond the Taliban. So,
and I would add, though, that the problem that in terms of this deadline and waiting the clock with Karzai is that the elections are in April, but if there's a runoff, we may not actually know who the next president of Afghanistan is until sometime in the summer. So waiting weeks could become waiting months. And so there are tensions and complications, but ultimately the U.S. is signaling that it's not rushing to pull out its last troops, that it would like to leave these 10,000 troops in, largely for what counterterrorism, anti-drug
largely
work.
Largely because it wants a military base in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Right, but the public reason being anti-terrorism, counter-terrorism,
that's
and drugs.
That's the public reason, yeah. Yes. Yeah. But they do want a NATO base in Afghanistan, and Karzai knows that, which is why, you know, he's reluctant to give them that.
When we look at those who are running to succeed Hamid Karzai, I mean, obviously there's going to be all sorts of concerns about how free or fair this election may be, Rachel. But are there amongst this sort of almost baker's dozen candidates, are there different flavours here for the Afghan people to choose from? Or, you know, as Jeffrey says, is it just a bunch of warlords?
There seems to be different flavours. I haven't scrutinised the list, I must confess, and there does seem to be a huge percentage of them that seem to be warlords. But at the same time, we're seeing some leaders, I believe, emerge, some contenders that are actually trying to be non-aligned, if you like, you know, Afghanistan being so factional at the moment. And there are contenders who are trying to allay that and be accommodating and choose VPs who are from opposing factions in a bid to kind of bring the sort of unity that Afghanistan is needing at the moment.
Jeffrey, if you were an Afghan, imagine you're an Afghan presidential candidate, and you know that security and peace, and then hopefully on from then, a growing economy is what your country needs. And you look at the situation and you think, well, look, I would like to talk to the Taliban, try and do a deal with them to ensure peace, but actually they don't really want to chat at the moment. I don't really feel like I can rely on my own Afghan security forces, because those of them that are competent might belong to someone else, and those that belong to me perhaps aren't very competent. You're going to be slightly attracted by the idea of having the Americans with you on your side, aren't
you? Sure, but you've got to be able to sell it to your people, and that's the reality check that we've been talking about. And I think that the other thing is a theme that comes up a lot around this table on this program, which is that, you know, you get countries like Afghanistan that appear to be fully functioning countries, but the fact is that Karzai has only limited authority over the country, and so he's not really in a position to deliver as much as we tend to think of the president of a country can deliver. So he has to step very carefully. He also wants to position himself. He can't run for a third term, but he's decided he's not going to retire to the French Riviera. He's going to hang around in Kabul, and so he wants to be a kingmaker. He wants to be a kind of elder statesman, and that's why he's playing his cards very close and not allying himself with his brother or any of the 10 other candidates to succeed him. And so much of what I think there's a lot of self-interest in what he's doing as he tries to position himself for the next era.
And Jeffrey, just on this issue of what the US wants, you know, obviously that, you know, there are various reasons for why the US might want to keep a base in Afghanistan. But given that we've talked a lot about the pivot to Asia, there are issues over what the US is going to do with Syria, there's issues over Iran, there's obviously the Israel-Palestine situation. Why does a presence in Afghanistan mean something to the US?
Well, we're going to talk about that. I think Bahrain is on our list in a couple of minutes,
and we're
going to talk about the US Fifth Fleet there. I mean, I think the US as a global superpower, as the global superpower, needs to have a presence. You can't fly jet fighters, and you know, if you see it from the perspective of the White House and the Pentagon, you can't deploy ships. And well, there are no Afghanistan's landlocked, but we're talking about bases. These these you know, F-16s don't go forever. You need to be able to land and refuel. You need to have pockets of troops in various places. And there aren't a lot of places near Afghanistan that want to host. And also, I think Afghanistan is so volatile, you know, that there is an argument from the American geopolitical perspective that they want to be there.
We're going to, in fact, move on to Bahrain now. Yeah. It's been 3 years since these events. Now, Bahrain was always the poor relation in the so-called Arab Spring. Saudi troops crossed the border at the invitation of the Bahraini emir rather quickly to help quell the uprising. Rachel Shabby, when we look back at this 3 years on, has anything really changed in Bahrain since those first protests?
Yeah, it's a really tough time of year, isn't it? These kind of three-year anniversaries are coming up thick and fast of the Arab uprisings. Egypt just had its, you know, the reality in Egypt 3 years on is pretty much a police state. Tunisia is probably a sort of beacon of hope in that spectrum. Bahrain is another terrible story and really shows up agendas. You know, the speed with which it was crushed, the speed with which Gulf forces rushed to assist Bahrain in crushing those pro-democracy protests. And, you know, of course, today the situation is just as bad as it ever was. You know, there's still absolute crackdown on any kind of opposition to the authorities, and I think as well the authorities have just made it illegal to criticize them or the flag, and the consequences of this being up to 7 years in prison and a large fine. So we're seeing that the situation is really just as bad in that country, and a huge embarrassment for the US that claims to be pro-democracy and freedom, and at the same time is prepared to turn a blind eye to these protests because there is a Fifth Fleet there.
This is the issue, Jeffrey, isn't it? That, you know, the US and the UK and other Western nations talk about the importance of democracy and how they want to help promote it. You know, George W. Bush even talked about, you know, lighting a beacon of democracy around the world. Not so keen on it in Bahrain, were we?
Well, you know, it's what we've what you've just been saying. It's about what's most important on your agenda, and while democracy is right up there for the U.S., the Fifth Fleet is based there. It is so essential for the global strategic the global strategy of the U.S. And they, more than anything, need to keep their Fifth Fleet there to maintain their priorities. And you've got 2,300 U.S. personnel stationed in Bahrain. You've got more than 20 ships, including aircraft carriers, with, I think, about 15,000 personnel on them. They've got to go somewhere. There has been talk over the last 3 years that the U.S. should pull out of Bahrain. But the question is, what's plan B? And as people look around the region, there isn't. You've got Dubai, possibly. Qatar already has a U.S. Air Force base, Al Udeid, and isn't keen to have more. The U.S. needs, because it's such a volatile region, to stay there. And yet, yes, there is a complete contradiction, conflict, hypocrisy, whatever word you want to say, because the crushing of human rights in Bahrain is blatant and real. The issue in Bahrain is this, that the country, which is just over 1 million, of its Muslim population, 70% are Shiites, yet the king and the ruling class are Sunni, and they do not want to give up their control of the country. And so you've got the Shiites as the underclass, the majority underclass, rebelling and saying, we should be masters in our own house. And they're not being allowed to be, and they are really being crushed. And the world is really turning a blind eye.
And Rachel, and that final point, the world is turning a blind eye, is true, because this isn't just the fact that Western governments are willing to turn it, you know, to look the other way. But it was, even at the time, it was, as we said, it was the poor relation of the Arab Spring. There wasn't a rush of journalists heading to Manama, were there?
No. I mean, I think the authorities there have made it very difficult to do any reporting from Bahrain, which partly explains it. Also, the government has been kind of using US and UK PR firms to really kind of lay on thick their side of the story.
So yes, we get emails from them.
I'm sure you do.
I would add one more thing, which is that in terms of the chess game that is Bahrain, that the concern is that, well, America and the West talk about human rights. If the Shiites take control of Bahrain, the Shiites, there is concern that Iran, which is a Shiite nation,
but that was always a concern with very little evidence to back it up. There was no Iranian pressure during the uprising.
That is part of what seemed to be a connection that worries the US and the West.
But I think these connections are just, you know, this kind of factional sectarian argument in Bahrain is really a line pushed by the authorities and swallowed by the US to imply that there is something sectarian and untoward going on in Bahrain, when clearly it is a people rising up against an authoritarian regime that refuses to cede power to anyone.
Or even share power.
Right,
exactly.
We're going to turn in a moment to another sort of third year anniversary Arab Spring story. We're also going to look at Venezuela as well, but that's all after this short break.
The Monocle subscription package is your year-round entry into the world of Monocle. For £90, you get a year of Monocle in print, and that's 10 magazines, including two double issues and our two seasonal newspapers, Alpino and Mediterraneo. You'll get access to online archives and an exclusive tote bag designed by our in-house team and made by our friends at Rutote of Japan. Plus, free shipping to wherever you are in the world. And that's all for £90 sterling. Or you can double your fun with our two-year package for £170, which comes with two bags and our exclusive organiser. So treat yourself, or even a loved one, to a Monocle subscription, available at monocle.com.
And you are back. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Rachel Shabby is still here. Jeffrey Kaufman is still here. We're going to talk about Venezuela in a moment. But first, to Libya, where a senior army official has been calling for the parliament to be suspended. The country's Prime Minister, Ali Zeidan, has replied by announcing today that the government is safe and security is under control. That's reassuring words, isn't it, Rachel? Don't worry, everything's fine. Ignore this colonel, everything's fine.
Don't worry, everything's cool. No, I mean, it seems like this guy, who is not even part of the army, he's now retired, Khalifa Haftar, he might have just glanced over to his neighbour in Egypt and got sort of delusions of grandeur about the size of Libya's own army, because clearly it's not really capable of mounting a coup, even if it were planning to do that, which...
Well, having said that, there were a bunch of guys that just kidnapped the Prime Minister not so long ago.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, but that takes a car and a driver and two other guys with a gun. I mean, you don't need a whole army to do that.
Well,
I mean, there's lots of armed groups in Libya, to be clear, which is one of the reasons why the army doesn't have that much strength, in the sense that a lot of the army defected to various opposition groups during the overthrow of Gaddafi, and have since left Libya in a state where there are many, many strong armed groups who refuse to disarm, and a very weak and, as so far, untrained army. So not likely that they're going to organise a coup. Also, the army leader has said that they aren't, so...
Well, yeah, they always tell the truth on these sorts of things. Jeffrey?
We talk about Libya a lot here, and I think the reason is that Libya has simply not recovered from the overthrow of Gaddafi to reinvent itself. And I think what we've seen this week is an effort to find a new solution to its ungovernability. Yeah. And I mean, it may have been illegitimate, but, indulge me for a minute. I covered the Arab Spring. I was there through much of 2011, and I was there when Gaddafi fell, and just listen for a moment as we play the Libyan national anthem that was banned under Gaddafi. So that, goes on. That anthem was actually written in 1951 for the king of Libya, banned in 69 when Gaddafi took over. I was in Green Square, which became Revolution Square, when it was sung for the first time after Gaddafi was overthrown. And in my 30-plus years of journalism, it was one of the most moving memories, moments that I can reflect on, because a country on the first day of its victorious revolution has every possibility. People had tears in their eyes. I felt it inside my core, and I'm, you know, far from growing up in Libya. Almost three years later, that was August of 11, all of that optimism is dissipated. All of the possibilities are gone. The militias, which are essentially regional mafias, control the streets. There are too many guns, and the country is incapable of advancing.
Was that optimism misplaced in the
start? Optimism is never misplaced on the day of an election, whether it's here in the UK, if it's your party that wins, or if it's a revolution. You know, this is the first time those people could breathe in 41, 42 years. So, no, there were possibilities. The problem is that the infrastructure, the mechanisms, the institutions of civil society didn't exist in a country like Libya, and they're not being built now.
But they might. I mean, you know, it's not doomed in the sense that, I mean, we've seen, I suppose, every country is unique, but we've seen various scenarios. We've seen Egypt, we've seen Tunisia, and these are options for Libya. It could, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of popular protest against the current government because it's been, you know, it hasn't managed to solve any problems and it certainly can't keep any of the armed groups at bay. Now, one option is, of course, a coup. The other option is some kind of, you know, for this government to step down and for a transitional interim, you know, technocratic government to step forward, as was the case with Tunisia. There are ways out of this. It is going to take a long time. Libya still doesn't have a constitution. It desperately needs one. Yeah, it's really, really messy.
I agree. I don't think all is lost in Libya. It's just that all is not won, and the road is so unclear. I mean, I think that the fear that so many who watch Libya have is that it will either return to an oppressive dictatorship or it will bump along as it is with people living it's a very wealthy country. Mm-hmm. It's only 6 million people. It has staggering reserves and sales of oil and gas. They don't need to live in the poverty that's been imposed on them for so many decades.
And of course, if we take the long view, the French Revolution, you know, the storming Bastille was 1789. It took 12 years until Napoleon took charge, and that was hardly democracy.
Right.
But France is okay now.
Yeah.
We'll see how France is in a little bit. Just finally, we were going to sort of at one stage talk about the weather, but I'm refusing to talk about the weather because I don't believe that's news. I do want to turn to Venezuela and Jeffrey. This is obviously a story that a country which you know very well, having covered Latin America from Miami and obviously in traveling around the region a lot before you were here. In Venezuela, in the last couple of days, we've had a lot of student protests, anti-government protests. Three people killed in the last protest in Caracas. And this is obviously a real test for Nicolas Maduro, isn't it?
It is. And I think the question is Venezuela approaching a tipping point? The Bolivarian revolution of Chavez, which he began the late 90s, did it die with him, and is Maduro trying to keep it alive, or can he sustain it and reinvent it? And the problem is that the mismanagement and corruption within the economy that was perpetuated by Chavez has just gone out of control. Inflation, it's hard to sit here and talk about 56% inflation, but that's really what it is. And basic goods are simply not to be found. The bolivar is the currency is fixed at an exchange rate. Officially, it's about six to a dollar, an American dollar. On the black market, you can get about 60. And so people are living in extremely hard circumstances. All of their dreams of a socialist revolution, bringing all that oil wealth to them, they simply, after so many years, you can't blame the previous administrations. This is a Chavez/Maduro problem. And so there are uprisings. the very people who, in fact, supported Chavez, many of them are rebelling, and that's what we're seeing. The question is, Maduro is calling them fascists. Maduro is saying they're trying to create a coup.
Which always helps, doesn't it?
It does. It's very convenient to call the opposition fascists, the people who say that you're not doing your job, to accuse them of trying to orchestrate a coup, much like, you may remember in 2002, Chavez was briefly ousted in a coup, and Maduro is saying that's what Leopoldo López, the charismatic leader of the opposition, the hardline opposition, is taunting Maduro, saying, come and arrest me, I'm at home, dare you, because I think he feels that will just galvanize people more. In Venezuela, it's funny, these oil states. We were just talking about Libya. Lots of oil, lots of wealth, and yet it doesn't hit the people. Venezuela, much the same story, much, much bigger country.
I think what you're saying there is Scotland shouldn't become independent because it might become an unstable oil state.
What do they call the Scottish pound?
Yeah. On that note, we'll leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman and Rachel Shabby, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
It certainly is Monocle 24, and in particular, it is Midori House here on Friday. By the way, I didn't say Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. It didn't really seem fitting in that last half hour, but we're in the home stretch now, so it is. Still to come in the second half of Midori House, we're going to hear why Finns and Brits, among others, are complaining about Olympic commentary. We'll head to Istanbul for the best of this year's film festival there, and we'll also check in with our man in Paris. But first, here's Jonathan with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. The UN aid chief, Valerie Amos, has urged the UN Security Council to act to increase humanitarian access in Syria as the US, France and Britain try to find common ground with Russia and China on a draft resolution on the situation there. The United Nations has said that some 9.3 million Syrians, that's nearly half the country's population, need help. Meanwhile, in neighbouring Jordan, around 1,000 protesters gathered in downtown Amman today to protest against the US Secretary of State John Kerry's Israeli-Palestinian peace plan. The demonstrators belonged mostly to Jordan's Muslim Brotherhood. Italy's Prime Minister has tendered his resignation less than a year after taking charge of the country's latest coalition. Enrico Letta announced he'll stand down hours after his biggest rival in the Democratic Party, Matteo Renzi, called for a change at the top. And Germany's agricultural minister, Hans-Peter Friedrich, has resigned amid accusations he leaked confidential information about a fellow lawmaker suspected of possessing child pornography, dealing a blow to Chancellor Angela Merkel and her two-month-old government. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for us to check in with one of our correspondents from around the globe. And today we're heading to Paris, the city of love on Valentine's Day. And Tom Burgess-Watson is right there for us. Tom, welcome to Midori House. We're not really talking about love, as it were, but we are going to talk about perhaps France's most eligible bachelor. Is that fair?
Well, a very happy Valentine's to you. And in fact, yes, there is a bit of a love in this first story that I wanted to talk to you about, because there was something of a love-in taking place across the Atlantic at the beginning of this week, because the French president, François Hollande, was there in Washington paying a state visit to the United States. That's the first state visit by a French president since 1996. That's almost 20 years that have gone by with no official state visits. And that was, of course, in the time of Jacques Chirac. So a lot has changed. The Franco-American relationship has been through all sorts of ups and downs in that two decades. But certainly Hollande was there basking in the sort of, sprinkled in stardust by that visit to the White House. And President Barack Obama seemed to hail Hollande as being quite his closest friend, to the extent that one journalist from Le Figaro, which is a French newspaper, cheekily asked Obama if France had now replaced the United Kingdom as Uncle Sam Sam's best European friend. So it was a huge love-in, lots of smiley photographs. Everyone seemed to be on the same page on pretty much everything, in particular international issues, where Obama said that Hollande had been absolutely exemplary and courageous in leading the way in Africa, particularly in Mali and the Central African Republic, but also in Syria and also on strategy regarding Iran. So it was a wonderful visit. I think Hollande couldn't have hoped for it to go better, because, of course, there was lots of speculation that he was going on his own, and that was a massive distraction from the outset. But it seemed to go very well indeed.
Yes, and quite rare for Francois Hollande to have a good news story. But not only has he had one this week, he's had a second. We keep on hearing that France's economy is in dire straits, that it's you know, one of the worst in Europe. And yet the GDP figures out now say that that actually France has reached the economy, the level of the economy has reached the level it was at before the crisis, doing better than indeed the UK.
Indeed. Well, these GDP figures that came out today are much better than expected. Growth in the fourth quarter of last year had been forecast, but not to the degree it was. But let's not get too excited. This was growth of plus 0.3% in the fourth quarter. And really what's driving that is an increase in domestic consumption and also slightly stronger exports. But I think there's a sense that, you know, France, obviously being the second biggest economy in the Eurozone after Germany, it's a good thing that both of those Eurozone leaders have registered rather improved figures for the fourth quarter. The French finance minister, of course, saying this shows that France is back on track. I think some people saying, you know, this is, of course, welcome news. And again, a big sigh of relief for President François Hollande, who's had nothing but rather dismal figures to report these last 16, 17 months. This figure does not cover up the fact that 11% of the workforce is out of a job right now. So lots still to be done. And just this week, France was given a rather grave warning about its debt situation. And France was warned that it's actually in the danger zone in terms of meeting deficit reduction targets. So I think France isn't entirely out of the woods, but certainly this figure is much more welcome than had it indicated that France was back in recession.
And finally, Tom, let's talk about Libération, one of the most famous French newspapers. It's, you know, like all French newspapers, it's been struggling, but it's in real trouble right now. Talk to us a little bit about how it got to this stage, and then we can discuss what it's going to try to do to get out of it, if anything.
Well, I went to visit Libération yesterday, and I was in their offices, and I wanted to get an elevator up to one of the higher floors. There are four lifts in the building, but only one of them was working. And the place looked very, very down at heel. I mean, the whole place, there was a rather sad atmosphere. And not surprisingly, the place has been hemorrhaging cash recently. Their sales dropped by 15% in the course of last year alone. Now, that is unheard of. I mean, across the board, newspaper sales in France have been slipping, but 15% in 1 year is a really serious situation. And I think that, you know, the problem here has been that Libération hasn't managed to move with the times. For example, it hasn't even got paywalls for quite a lot of its content, and that's something that means that if you can get it online for free, and if, you know, in this environment where there are a lot of free newspapers now in France handed out to you as you do your morning commute, you've really got to be quite savvy if you want to make cash as a newspaper in France right now. And the staff were told last week about plans to sort of revamp the brand, which would mean, amongst other things, making a cultural centre out of their headquarters in Paris, creating a cafe, a TV studio, and a business area to start new for new upstart businesses. But they didn't like that plan one little bit. Their Saturday edition of the newspaper had a huge front page, which read, "We are a newspaper, not a coffee shop, not a cultural centre, none of these other things." So I think there's a feeling amongst the staff that they've been betrayed by their shareholders, who are hoping to simply cash in on the brand and put sort of print journalism on a bit of a back burner.
Tom Burgess-Watson, we'll see how that develops over time. Thank you very much for joining us from Paris. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Time now for our daily review segment. Today we're looking at cinema, and in particular Turkish cinema, and in particular the Istanbul Film Festival. It's been running for 13 years. It began this year's edition anyway, last night, and our very own Caleb Lauer has been looking at it for us, and will be looking at it for us for the next few days as well. Caleb joins us now from Istanbul. Hello, Caleb.
Hi, how are you?
Very good indeed. So there's a bit of a Turkish flavour, as one would expect, to the Istanbul Film Festival. Before we talk about some of the films that you're hoping to see over the next few days, give us a bit of a background to the festival itself.
Well, yeah, as you say, this is a homegrown Turkish film festival. It was started in 2001 by two young women, Pelin Turgut and Sera Cilev. And I spent the morning talking with Pelin. And she basically explained, you know, how this festival came to be and how it started. Pelin and Sarah were two young ravers who were, you know, running these underground raves, and they were also writing and doing journalism. And one of the big cinema companies in Turkey wanted to start an alternative event, you know, combining art, social change, etc. So they basically, you know, took it upon themselves to start up this film festival, and it's been running for 13 years. And one of the most sort of interesting things about the conversation this morning was how much Turkey itself has changed in those 13 years. Pelin was telling me about a time in the early years where they still have a section about the Kurdish population in Turkey. But in those days, you know, in 2001, 2002, 2003, you couldn't say the word Kurdistan without sort of tempting legal and perhaps violent reaction from society at large. So it was a real sort of groundbreaking attempt to start a different type of conversation in Turkey, and they've succeeded. And one of the sort of the most significant signs of that is a lot of those things that were taboo, gay and lesbian rights, the Kurdish issue, Armenian issue, today these are very, very normal mainstream events, mainstream topics.
And indeed, one of the films that's going to be showing at this festival, Ruboski Mon Amour, does look at the Kurdish issue in quite some detail.
Şimdi vicdanımız aslında toplumsal vicdanımız gömüldü ve bunu bilinçli bir şekilde.
Yeah, this is one of the films I'm particularly looking forward to. This is a documentary made by Bülent Gündüz. And for people that don't know, the story is that a couple years ago, the Turkish military bombed a group of Kurdish smugglers who were basically smuggling oil back and forth over the Iraqi border. The military's version of events is that these were mistakenly thought of as terrorists, and some F-16s dropped some warheads on them, killed 34 of these guys. Most of them were kids. It was a real tragic event. Now, what's interesting about this issue is that it highlights not only the core issue, which is that the Kurds in Turkey have had a really, really difficult history, and the country is still coming to terms with that, but it highlights some of the other things that have been happening on the periphery of this event. For example, when the bombing happened, no Turkish media reported it for hours, and it was essentially communicated to the public at large via Twitter. And this was one of the first times that people started to realize the power of Twitter for reporting news. And we saw that later on in with events like Gezi, where social media was actually compensating for the inability of the mainstream media to report on these issues. Another issue that comes up out of that was when the government apologized for this tragedy. They actually, a Turkish columnist said, from a government-backed newspaper, said, "This is not how you apologize for something like this." And he was fired the next day. This type of thing has sort of become the norm in Turkey, not just with regards to the Kurdish issue, but with regards to society at large.
And Caleb, when you look at, you know, the reaction that this film is likely to get, particularly in the current situation and all the problems that journalists are facing in Turkey at the moment, is there still something quite daring about this film festival putting a film like this on?
That is what is one of the great paradoxes of Turkey, or it illustrates one of the great paradoxes of Turkey. There is an intense tendency towards media control underway in Turkey. It seems every day journalists and the media in general are under more and more pressure. But at the same time, the society is undoubtedly becoming more and more open. Just take the Kurdish issue, for example. 10 years ago, Pelin, the woman who started this festival with Sera, they were afraid of showing a film about Kurds, basically. They feared that they would go to jail. Today, nobody will notice in Turkey that this film was shown. They will notice the content of the film, and they will be challenged by the content of the film. But the simple fact of showing a film sympathetic to the Kurdish movement is not even an issue anymore. And in fact, anybody that would try to make an issue of it would be sort of laughed out of the room. This has happened with gay and lesbian rights, the LGBT movement. This has happened with the Armenian genocide issue. And a lot of taboos have been basically broken in the last 10 years. At the same time, you have this intense movement towards media censorship. It's a very, very contradictory and paradoxical situation.
And Caleb, just finally, let's talk about the blue wave.
Sahilde yolunu bulmak için kullanılıyor. Buldunuz mu yolunuzu sahilde?
Sizin yazlık nerede Perin?
It's come out of a screenwriter's lab that's sort of linked to the Sundance Festival.
That's right. The women that put this film together had their screenplay workshopped, basically, by people from the Sundance Institute. This is one of the things that Sundance does. They sort of go around to different festivals and work with emerging artists to sort of get their script, workshop it for 4 intense days, and then it comes out better than ever. And these types of partnerships are what are particularly interesting about this film festival itself. The film festival is partnered with people like Sundance, but it also is partnered with cities around the region. It shows in 30 different cities, and they use this live streaming technology to show the films that are on during the festival in cities in the region, like Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, in Ramallah, in Jerusalem. And through the technology that they use, they can have audiences in those places interacting with the directors after the movie for the Q&A segment of the show. So these types of partnerships are basically what make this festival so much bigger than a simple Istanbul-only centered film festival. It's a regional event.
Caleb Lauer in Istanbul, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this. We're going to end the show very soon with a bit of a wonderful commentary from the Winter Olympics. But to take us there, this is riding high in the charts here in the UK. It's Strong by London Grammar. Strong there by London Grammar from their album If You Wait. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Welcome back. We're going to end the show now with something rather spectacular. I hope you'll agree. I assume you've been watching the Winter Olympics. You know, what's not to love? There's the sweeping on ice. There's the one where they ski. stop and shoot something, then ski again, and then there's snow slope, which is frankly ridiculous. And talking of frankly ridiculous, here's a bit of the commentary on the good old BBC for the snow slope.
Well, both Ed and Amy crying about ongoing.
Oh my God.
All professionalism going straight out the window here.
I think we're allowed to cry though.
Well, slope star Jamie Nichols for five.
According to the critics, those BBC hosts you heard there were, quote, puerile and hyperactive. Who'd have thought? Hundreds of complaints later, the Beeb apologised. But it's not just the Brits up in arms. Oh no, the Finns too. Kai Kunas, a veteran commentator, has been criticised for his words of wisdom.
Jäähyä kestetty. Kanada tulee, Kanada tulee, Kanada tulee, Kanada vetää. Saadaanko kiekko pois? Ei saada! Ei saada! Megan Agosta vetää niin valtavan Sputnikin Suomen maaliin!
Did he just say Sputnik? Who better to talk us through these sporting scandals than a man who grew up dreaming of becoming Finland's first ski jump champion, Markus Hippi, and a man who I'm told is one of the finest skeleton bobbers this side of the Milton Keynes Snow Dome, Tom Edwards.
That's right, Steve.
Markus, first of all, talk us through what Kai Kunas was saying there. What was he commentating on?
What we heard over there was an example of what he's been going on television now. The incident he got most attention for was when he was pretending, when he was imitating basically a cuckoo clock when he was watching the Swiss women's ice hockey team playing. But unfortunately,
how do you do a cuckoo clock?
Cuckoo, cuckoo.
Okay,
unfortunately,
well,
unfortunately, you can't find that from anywhere from the archives because that's all been removed. What we just heard was him referring to a Canadian ice hockey team being like Sputnik when it comes to their way of playing that game. I don't know about how it goes with Brits, but I have to say that when it comes to this controversy in Finland, basically half of the nation wants to get rid of Kai Kunnas now. They love moaning, and Kai Kunnas hasn't actually done Winter Olympic Games before. So his new style, he's quite expressive. He's got quite a lot of sense of humour over there, even though I have to say that I'm not sure how much that sense of humour appeals to everyone. I don't know, do you think imitating a cuckoo clock is funny?
Don't try and get me to judge Finnish humour, really don't.
Context is everything, I always think.
It really is. Tom Edwards, Britain has a fine tradition of great commentators from Kenneth Walthamstow to Barry Davis to David Coleman. These youngsters who did the snow slope, they won't be added to that pantheon of greats, will
no,
they?
No, the pantheon has no place for Tim Warwood, Amy Fuller and Ed Lee, who we heard allegedly commentating on a sporting event in the introduction. I think one of the problems is, similar to what Markus mentioned there with his Finnish counterpart, a novice when it comes to the unique challenges of the Winter Olympics. These were novices, and they shouldn't really have been let loose on an event like this. Having said all of that, I think people can forgive a bit of exuberance. The thing that really upset the British viewers and listeners was the fact that Warwood, Fuller and Lee, because of the nature of the competition in that the British girl who subsequently won this medal had already completed her run, she needed subsequent athletes to fail. And they basically
cheered on failure.
Cheered when people fell over. And that really offended the traditional British sense of fair play, Steve. And that you cannot do in any theatre.
I have to say that when I've been following this discussion, both in the UK and in Finland, my conclusion is that people are incredibly conservative. They're basically allergic to anything new. And something I quite appreciate the Finnish Broadcasting Company for is that they actually try to come up with something new for these games. They actually hired the most famous Finnish actor internationally, believe it or not, even though this guy is relatively unknown outside of Russia, Ville Haapasalo, who's actually a real superstar in Russia, he was commentating the games for the first 2 days. And some people loved him. Just completely hated his style. He's not a sports expert, he's an actor.
And is this part of the issue, Tom, when it comes to something like the Winter Olympics, when it's, you know, who do you turn to do the commentary on the curling? So either you go for your great sports commentators and you give them a big book and say, learn everything there is to know about curling in a month, go. Or you get people who really know, say, snow slope. And these guys really did. I mean, they knew their stuff. I listened to a lot of it and didn't understand a single word, but they obviously knew what they were talking about, but perhaps they don't quite have the commentator's sensibility.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think you mentioned Barry Davis earlier, a stalwart of the scene, and probably there's this tendency to, you know, require the new, to require something, you know, more dynamic. The programmers say, well, we can't just have Barry coming along and guiding us through in that nice armchair style. And we need people like Tim Ward or Amy Fuller. But what can you expect? Amy Fuller was the teammate of Jenny Jones.
So, of course,
she's
going to
get overexcited. And she's probably going to cheer the failure of other athletes because it's her teammate. I don't think it would be unreasonable to expect her to keep her emotions in check. But I think in terms of Tim Ward and Ed Lee, that was a question of they were the only people who knew the event.
But there also has become, in recent years, this sort of tendency for commentators, particularly in the UK, but also elsewhere, to be a bit more jingoistic and sort of support our boys, hasn't there?
It's very regrettable. I would much prefer to go back to the old days. You think, you mentioned some of the classic British efforts, or English efforts, I would even say. You know, they think it's all over, it is now. That's the classic English understatement, Steve, for which the BBC, for example, used to be so loved.
Interestingly enough, in Finland, the style has always been about supporting our boys and our girls over there. It's always been very much about us, us, us. It's very patriotic what these games in Finland, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's also so incredibly sensitive. So basically what people want is to having the old voices over there doing that the very same way it's been done before, because in the end it's about traditions and us.
I'd like to have one of the famous voices of Finnish breakfast television from a few years ago wheeled back out for the Winter Olympics.
Are you talking about Markus Hippi?
Markus Hippi! I think he'd be first class.
I was actually forced to do some ice hockey interviews a few times, but I'm quite happy I don't need to do Finnish ice hockey over here.
I must say, ice hockey commentary must be the hardest thing to do because nothing happens and Elmer goes a goal!
I know!
There we are. On that sort of weird screech from Marcus, we're going to leave things. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and Rachel Shabby. The show was produced by Marcus Hippi when he wasn't getting excited about Finnish commentary. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anade Satuma. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. Next up, more Marcus. We're down on the farm for the menu to visit perhaps Ireland's most notorious cookery school, Ballymoo. Then at 2200s, it's the Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. Midori House will be back at the same time on Monday. Do tune in for that, 1800 hours London time. But for all of us here at Midori House, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.